shares,
market,
the S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that's free, so you don't have to pay in four equal installments. Sound familiar? We'll get to that in a minute. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is Nirvan Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Good day, Captain. How are you?
I'm excellent. It's a bit rainy outside. It's a Sydney, cold, rainy Sydney morning, but, you know.
Almost looks like London.
Oh, it does a little bit, doesn't it? It's a nice studio here. We can look out the window and see things, and often it's a good day. It's a bit grey and a bit drizzly, but anyway. Mate, the good news is I'm here with you. We're recording a podcast for our dozens and dozens of foolish listeners.
I thought thousands.
You know, we'll downplay it a little bit, mate. We're all about under-promising and over-delivering here at the Motley Fool. All right, mate. So speaking of deliveries or lack thereof, and speaking of four equal installments, the company on everyone's lips is Afterpay. Now, it's been the rock star stock of 2018 until Wednesday.
Yeah.
In a short, I want to say 60 or 90 minutes on Wednesday afternoon, the shares fell almost 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be fair, if you bought at cheaper prices, you've still made five, six times your money. So you're not probably crying too much. But one of our colleagues, Andrew Leggett, who did buy it at cheaper prices, and well done, Leggett, you've done exceptionally well. He said, we call it a spiffy pop at the Motley Fool. If you make in a day, same as your cost base, doesn't happen very often. He had a spiffy drop on Wednesday. The share price fell more than what he originally paid for the shares. Mm. Again, he's still in clover, so he's not complaining too loudly. But mate, what happened to Afterpay? Why did it fall out of bed?
So there was an announcement out yesterday that the Senate is going to start an inquiry into what they called Afterpay and payday lenders.
Ooh. That's not good company to be in, is it?
No. I'm surprised. This is one of the things that we've talked about a number of times is there's going to be a point of time at which people are going to look at Afterpay and say, or regulators are going to look at Afterpay, or lawmakers are going to look at Afterpay and say, well, you know, this is another type of debt.
Right.
Right. It's a short time period, right? You know, it's four equal installments.
Yep.
It's not large amounts, but it's still another type of debt.
All right. So just the people listening to us, they would say, of course it is. Why are we even making that distinction?
Oh, it's because people have lots of different types of debt, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have debt in your credit card. You could have debt as a mortgage. You could have payday lending.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that most of the other types of debts are regulated in one way or the other, right?
Yep.
And for most of the other types of, if you for example take a mortgage, you're going to get. As the Royal Commission has shown, you're going to have the banks check whether you're creditworthy or not, whether you can afford it or not. And the question is, at least in this case, are Afterpay and others regulated as such in the sense that are they doing enough to make sure the people who are borrowing the money are going to be eventually able to pay, or is it going to put them in some form of, a debt stress, so to speak? So I think it's the right thing to do. I don't think it is, at this point, we can say that, Afterpay has done anything wrong. Afterpay has created a category in some sense. Mm. But maybe regulation will actually be helpful for them.
Yeah, so here's the thing. Afterpay navigates a nice little loophole.
Mm.
If you provide debt, if you're a credit card provider, a personal loan provider, a home loan provider, a car loan provider, if you provide debt to somebody and say, if you borrow this money, you've got to pay it back, the Parliament has said that regulators, in this case APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, has control over what you do and you have to comply with what they call the credit code.
Mm-hmm.
That's all fine, but the key thing about whether or not you have to comply with the credit code is whether or not you charge interest.
Mm-hmm.
So Afterpay says, no, we're not charging interest. We're going to get some money from the retailer on one hand. We're going to charge late fees if they don't pay on the other hand, but we don't charge interest. And so as far as the regulators, as far as Parliament's concerned, these guys aren't providing a debt product, at least in the way we normally consider it, and so they're not subject to the credit code. Now, the credit code would require a whole lot, as you've already said, of paperwork, of credit checks, of all sorts of stuff, responsible lending practices, know your customer. Afterpay has kind of skirted through it. And I call it a loophole. That's a little unfair. I'm not suggesting anyone's doing anything improper. Afterpay is absolutely complying with everything they're obliged to comply with. It's completely appropriate. The problem is Parliament saying, hang on, I'm not sure that's what we meant. Mm. We kind of meant lay-by and stuff like that. We didn't really mean buy now, pay later with no interest, and therefore you get away with it. So that's why this is particularly important for Afterpay, because it may well change the playing field.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can make an argument, right, that the late fee is a type of interest.
Mm, okay.
So maybe they are trying charging interest when you're not paying.
Yes,
so maybe, it's like credit cards, right? Where, you know, you have 6 months interest free, and after that we charge you interest.
Right. I think that's the interesting. Look, I'm. It's hard, right? We got different horses in this race. So Afterpay was a recommendation of our service, Motley Fool Discovery 2017, which is now over a year old. So we recommended it, made a decent amount of money, in fact, a large amount of money for our members. So that's great. So on one hand, you know, we kind of, you'd expect us to be cheerleaders for these things. On the other hand, the Motley Fool is pretty fortunate and kind of to some degree deliberately so, because we structure ourselves that we are not there to be blind cheerleaders for anything or any company. We're not in the lobby group kind of space where everything's good and everything's wonderful, and we're there to provide one-eyed cheerleading for any company that we might happen to own or recommend. In this case, I think if we take a broader, you know, if we're here for the individual investor, we're here for the individual consumer, and I don't think it's unfair that Afterpay at least should be, if not constrained, at least subject to some more requirements to make sure they're not putting their customers in undue stress.
I think that's fair. And as I said, I think in the beginning, I mean, this might work out to their advantage. It might make it actually, they're already a pretty big player. Mm. And one could think that, you know, there are copycats already out there, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, this, if there are regulations, it makes it harder for the new entrants actually to come and disrupt, right? So this could actually be a good thing for them. And as I said, I completely agree that, you know, maybe some sort of regulation or some sort of at least oversight is meaningfully useful and required, and it may not actually hurt their business.
That's kind of appropriate. If we were taking on debt, you want to make sure that the people extending debt are able to afford, able to pay it back. In some cases, these people are taking on Afterpay debt on top of credit cards, on top of personal loans, and at some level, it's not healthy for individuals. And frankly, this is the thing. I think when I've been accused before of not blindly cheerleading everything that makes life better for investors. You know, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of cutting corporate tax rates, for example, and I've been bagged on Twitter and elsewhere of saying, you know, I thought you guys were about investors and I thought you were about making more money for shareholders. How can you want to do something that makes less money for shareholders? The answer I tend to give is that we are long-term investors by nature. Anything that makes the economy more fragile and more susceptible to internal or external shocks actually activates against the long-term interests of shareholders. So there's always going to be booms and busts, but you know, we're long-term shareholders. We have 5+ year time horizons. Yes, you can make a little bit more money now doing something like Afterpay is doing, or having lower corporate tax or something else. To the extent that those policy decisions impact on the economy, it may well be robbing Peter to pay Paul by getting a little bit more now, but having to pay for it down the track.
Absolutely.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's stick with retail. Let's talk about a couple of big retail stories of the last week. Mm-hmm. One here, one overseas, and I'm going to ask you to talk about them individually, and I'll ask you a question more broadly about retail. But let's start with here at home. Mm. Poor Reject Shop. Mate, it has been an awful, awful ride over the last few years for shareholders. I will disclose that one of our complete mistakes was to recommend the Reject Shop at ShareAdvisor, so we celebrate our successes, we'll take our lumps equally. Shares fell 40-odd, or maybe 33%, I think, by the end of Wednesday. On the back of news that profit that was supposed to come in for the half year around $17 million is going to come closer to $10 million. And same-store sales were down 4% in the last 7 or 10 weeks. Mm. That's a world of hurt, mate. Is the Reject Shop dead in the water? Is there more to come? What's going on with the Reject Shop?
Well, can I start by, you know, by saying that the Reject Shop has been rejected by the shareholders?
Stealing my puns, nice work.
So, it was not a fun day to have been a Reject Shop shareholder.
It's
for those
really
people
not.
Who, you know, the shares, I think, fell a lot yesterday.
That's a technical term for it.
Yeah. I mean, with many of these things, it's hard to know exactly what is going on, right? I mean, same-store sales are, what, down for the first 16 weeks or something like that, about 3%?
I don't think it's quite 16 weeks, but it's the first, beginning of a few weeks.
15 weeks.
Something like that.
Yeah, 15 weeks down like 2.4% with some acceleration.
That's
towards,
a lot.
With some acceleration in recent weeks.
Sorry,
right?
Yes.
So,
and that recent deceleration is minus 3.9%.
Yeah, so
the numbers are getting worse.
Things are getting worse. Yep. Now, the question really is why? I mean, as an investor, you'd think, you know, why is it getting worse, right?
I wish we knew.
And the company's not really helping. But, you know, the company basically blamed
Everything.
Everything is wrong with the economy. Yep. The economy is not doing well. The economy is not growing. But on the other hand, when the economic data comes out, we see, hey, you know, the economy is actually growing really fast.
Yeah.
Or as fast as you'd expect a developed economy to grow.
Yeah.
Our unemployment rates are low. Mm-hmm. It's not really rising. Okay, there are some pockets of, you know, people are not getting as much work as they want and things like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, it's really a good economy.
Yeah.
There's no recession around in the corner.
Or is there? So here's the thing.
Yeah.
If you're right. Every retailer in particular going through tough times will blame everything else. The weather, the economy, the consumer, the company. It's always someone else's fault, right? So let's assume that's probably what's going on here. Mm. But the reject shop's customers are probably the most, you used the word earlier today, vulnerable.
Yes.
They're the ones with least capacity to absorb cost increases or, you know, interest rates are going up, all that kind of stuff's going on. Isn't that possible? Isn't it just possible at some level? I'm an optimist by nature, but if I was to look a bit more clear-eyed, isn't it possible this is the canary in the coal mine for retail?
It could be. So I guess, you know, when you said interest rate, one thing that came to my mind just right now is, I mean, the interest rates have actually crept up. You know,
right.
Some of them, you know, almost all banks in unison raised rates not too long ago, right?
Yep.
And then, you know, people are tapping into things like Afterpay and so on. So, you know, debt is already there. It's already climbing. Interest rates are going up.
Mm-hmm.
Cost of living basically, therefore, is going up. And for, as you said, most vulnerable people, it is difficult. That's one possibility, right? The other possibility is that maybe Afterpay screwed up. pardon my use of the language.
Surely not.
And what, you know, I think with these sort of retail, so, I mean, they're selling the cheap toothpaste and the cheap, you know, tissue paper or whatever else in the cheap chips.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, you need to also find the fidget spinners or whatever it is, the hot product, right? And if you miss the hot product, you missed a trick.
Yeah.
Right. And then that can have an impact. To the company's discredit, they didn't really tell us what was the reason other than these broad reasons.
So they gave us the alleged reasons, but they didn't give us enough information below that to try and work out what's going on. Now, there are fewer people coming to the shores. They're shopping less frequently. Is there less being spent per basket?
Yeah.
Are there particular categories that are being impacted, particular stores or regions? That was completely absent from the announcement on Wednesday.
Yeah. And I mean, the other possibility, I mean, there are a lot of possibilities here. The other possibility is, like, you know, Amazon Prime has been discounting. You know, I have a discounted access to Amazon Prime, although, you know, I just have it and have not bought anything from Amazon Prime. But, you know, people might be using Amazon Prime. Maybe they're using Kogan. And, you know, getting things delivered, you know, the cheap toothpaste, you know, is available at Amazon Prime. You just buy it and it comes to your home instead of you going to...
Even Kogan, mate. They're selling dishwasher tablets and toothpaste and coffee pods.
Exactly.
And,
So, I mean, these two companies, if they're selling things online and you can just order it from your phone, why would you maybe want to go to a reject shop? And you can price compare now on your phone, right?
Yep, so, totally. So maybe
it's a combination of things, right? You know,
I reckon that, you know, my guess, I'll answer my own question. I reckon that's a very significant part of it. I think there's, so I will say again, our colleague Andrew Leggett, who I mentioned earlier, his view is it's not an online issue. I'm guessing that in recent times, it's more likely to be that than not. I think if you think about what's happened to the reject shop, yes, it's been hit by Aldi, it's been hit by Kmart, plenty of a competition, but that stuff isn't new. The stuff that's new year on year, the decline they've suffered in the last 16 weeks, as you say, it's not the fact Kmart did something 5 years ago or Aldi entered the market 10 years ago.
Yeah.
This is something new and sudden. Now, maybe it's a blip. Maybe it's just the company screwed up their merchandising or pricing.
Yeah.
That's all possible. Or just maybe the bargain hunters who would otherwise go to the reject shop and try and get something cheap because everyone loves a bargain and there's a whole lot of people out there who will go to a reject shop looking, just you know, looking around and seeing what they can find. I think it's very possible. I would even argue probable, though, as I said, Andrew disagrees. So, you know, there's room for different thought. I reckon it's pretty likely, in my view, that people are bargain hunting online and simply not going to the reject shop anymore.
Yeah.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's go over the ocean. Let's cross the Pacific. Because speaking of retail challenges, Sears is a name that most Australians would have heard, maybe not super familiar with. The US department store chain entered what the Yanks like to call euphemistically Chapter 11 protection, what we like to call bankruptcy.
Yeah,
it's really doing it tough. Well, by definition, right? It may not go out of business, but things are getting really, really difficult for Sears. Not long after Toys R Us went into administration, it's the latest in a line of retail bankruptcies, and it's kind of giving more rise to the idea of the ghost mall concept, that simply fewer and fewer people are shopping in physical locations, certainly fewer people at department stores. Give us a really quick summary, because not many people know or own Sears, but give us a quick summary of the Sears story and tell us whether we should be concerned about department stores here at home.
Right. So Sears used to have, large number of, their big Sears. They're like, the big box format, mm-hmm. Clothes to everything else that you could buy across North America, so both US and Canada. Mm-hmm. They also actually run the Kmart stores, or they bought the Kmart chain in the US not too long ago. Right. So they're closing stores significantly. They're basically... Mm-hmm. Closing signal. And when they say bankruptcy, what they basically mean here is that basically they are bankrupt, mm-hmm. and they're trying to they're trying to salvage what they can.
Yep.
What they call the most profitable stores. And I think, off the top of my head, I think at peak they had maybe 700 plus stores or something like that.
Yeah, it was big, right?
It was huge.
It was the kind of Pan-American department store. It was kind of, there's Nordstrom's and Macy's, and they're the higher end. A few of them in the bigger areas.
Yeah.
Sears, I want to say, is American Meyer. I reckon that's
It's basically the American Meyer plus DJs, David Jones maybe, put together as one. One of the things with these retail bankruptcies is they tend to happen around Christmas time, closer to Christmas time, because the suppliers and people who are providing products, they get they start worrying about giving companies like Sears credit. So they start tightening the terms, and which makes it very difficult for a company which probably has $5 billion plus of debt. Mm-hmm. It makes it difficult for them to pay the debt, pay the bondholders, and that's usually the time that these sort of companies basically say, okay, we need to enter sort of bankruptcy protection. So I think it's the Amazon story there. It's mm-hmm. the story that the malls are doing it tough, and that's really with what retail spending online mm-hmm. in the US is less than 20% of the total online spending is
which is kind of on one level huge, right? Like if you think one of every five retailers spent online, that's enormous.
Yeah.
But I think you're making the point that it's got a bit of way to go in terms of its growth from here.
Yeah. So it was zero, let's say, 20 years ago. Now it's 20%.
Yeah.
And at 20%, we have had Sears closing, Toys R Us closing.
Trying to give any other retailer in a physical retail space who could open up 20 years ago and have a 20% market share, it doesn't happen.
No.
We haven't had Aldi come to the market here and take 20% market share. No. We haven't. It doesn't happen in any other kind of facet of life. Some maybe in some industrial products or where there's big technological change, but this is that technological change.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. So, and I think, it's inevitable that's going to, I think, continue happening. It's much faster in other places. Like, the online spending is much higher in places like China, for example, largely because they don't have the infrastructure of, right. So this, even you have the infrastructure issue, you skip the infrastructure and you go online, right?
And that's fascinating. Sorry, just quickly. That's fascinating for both China and India. The kind of evolution the Australian consumer went through, we kind of had the corner store, then we had the big department stores in town, then we had the supermarkets everywhere, then we kind of went department stores and then online. That's kind of been our journey.
Yeah.
But it's very possible the developing world skips mall-based retail altogether and goes straight from corner store to pretty much get it online, get it delivered.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just use India as an example. Mm. So if you're in Bangalore, I mean, they have beautiful big malls, right? But it takes in Bangalore approximately, I would say, like, maybe 1 hour to do 5 kilometers. Mm. That's a lot
of traffic. You're not driving to the shop, are you?
Yeah, that's a lot of traffic, right?
Right,
so
right. This is a city of 8.5 million people in 2011. I've just Googled it.
Yeah.
So let's say it's, what, 10 million now?
Oh, probably 12, maybe.
Right. So that's effectively half of Australia in a single mm-hmm. city. And they're going to not have any significant, in your view, in my view, any significant big shopping centres to speak of. Certainly a number that would be required to serve that sort of population.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So a lot of those people are going online. But that's Bangalore, which has, infrastructure, which mm-hmm. has got the malls to have the, or it's got the roads and maybe the airport and the other transport to have the infrastructure to support things, right? But if you're going to tier two cities...
Okay.
Those tier two cities are going to have it even harder, right? But those people have access to 4G. So I could today speak with people in, interiors of India, in villages of India, on using something like, let's say WhatsApp, mm-hmm. And have a video call. It will be a very good quality video call. So in other words, isn't they have cool internet access.
Yeah.
So those people, if they want to buy something, they could actually today go online and, you know, use the Indian Amazon, like Flipkart, for example, and buy stuff.
Now owned by Walmart, interestingly.
Now owned by Walmart, right?
So it's kind of that story of Walmart basically realizing that big Walmart supercenters in India aren't the future. Flipkart may well be the future for on retail there.
Yeah.
All right, mate. So bring it back home. Meijer and DJ's, Target, Big W, Kmart. Are these guys endangered species? Are they on the way to death, or is there a place for some or all of them in the future?
Well, in my world, they're all dead, right? They're not really growing.
Yeah, but in your world, anything growing less than 20% is dead. So let's come back to Scott world or to the real world. I will say without meaning to be harsh. You know, do these guys all exist in 10 years' time?
Not all of them.
Okay.
No. It's just hard, incredibly hard. I mean, you know, I think some of them will exist, you know, as those people who can have an online and offline experience, they're going to exist. You know, maybe there are things that you want to have an online experience and an offline experience.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe more niche type of format things will exist.
Yeah.
I think of malls as basically as meeting places. You know, they'll become basically like, you know, the movies and the restaurants and stuff like that.
So. I agree with you. I think that the other thing for me is even if there are some, there will still be retail being done.
Yeah.
But if you think about a decently sized Westfield or a decently Stockland or something else, we get together every Friday at Bondi Junction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the Westfield Bondi Junction, I won't know exactly because I don't know the shopping centre that well. But in that shopping centre, there's going to be a DJ's and or a Meijer.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a Kmart and or a Target and or a Big W.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be specialty retail stores. It just doesn't seem likely to me, even if people are shopping physically in 10 years' time, they will be, to be able to have effectively what are kind of duplicate-ish stores. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to delineate the difference between a DJ's and a Meijer and a Target and a Big W and a Kmart, you could probably do it. And yes, there are differences. Whether there's enough differences and, frankly, enough retail dollars to keep five of those stores in the same shopping centre, it strikes me as remarkably unlikely. Yes, you might want a cheap T-shirt from a department store. Well, you don't need Target and Big W and Kmart for that. You might want to buy cosmetics over a counter. Well, you don't need DJs and Meijer and Target for that. You know, you start to break this back and think, whatever I buy online, whatever I buy in physical retail, imagining the five groups are still in business and successful in 10 years' time is kind of a bit hard to imagine.
Yeah, right? It's incredibly hard, I think. Yeah, that's almost unlikely.
So we're not buying retail shares?
Well, you know, you could buy retail shares if they look attractive, they have a specialized, you know, I guess, trajectory or, mm-hmm. You know, they have something special about them. Right, I mean...
So much special about discount department stores, is there?
Well, not really. Like, I mean, if you think about it, you know, Amazon is opening retail stores, right? Apple has been opening retail stores. So, I mean, the retail works.
Yeah.
It just works in a different format now.
Look at what you're selling.
Yeah.
And there's no surprise that Apple has the, I want to say, highest sales per square foot of any retailer in the world, any large retailer.
And I mean, no, Amazon is opening retail stores without any cashiers, right? In a different world, things will exist in a different way, but not in the way we see it today.
There you go. Own Meijer and DJ shares at your peril. In fact, DJ's not listed here anymore. It's owned by Voice
Africa. But
almost they still dead. Exist. They still exist.
Almost dead.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of South Africa, I'm going to make a very awkward segue here, but stick with me. We'll edit this out later. We're going to move international, specifically the Australian dollar. Now, the dollar's been kind of... steadily falling, 71-ish cents, depending on what you look at and when you look at it. It wasn't that long ago. It was $1.10, and certainly even more recently, it was 80 cents. With a falling Australian dollar, we know it does a few things. It makes the imports that we buy more expensive. And so if you filled your car up at a petrol station recently, you know exactly what that feels like. It makes computers and TVs more expensive, relatively speaking, because we're paying more Australian dollars for every dollar or yen or renminbi or US dollar we're buying overseas. It also makes our exports more competitive because overseas buyers can simply spend less of their dollars to get the same amount of our stuff in Australian dollars. So in that kind of – with that kind of backdrop, how do investors play the falling Australian dollar?
Cool. You already answered that. I mean –
Well, we know the economic impact, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's the same investing opportunities, are there?
I guess the most obvious ones are, you know, those companies that have, especially in the sort of consumer discretionary world, who have got an export opportunity, or those who have a significant export business, I think they are likely to do well. You know, and if you're selling things in those companies that have sales in, for example, in US dollars, they're going to be reporting higher sales effectively in Australian dollars, right? I mean, those people who are buying, say, software or, you know, maybe A2 milk or maybe Blackmore's vitamins. I mean, you know, they're selling the same volume, probably charging the same US dollar amount, and therefore, in Australian dollar terms, you know, you're getting more money coming in. So that's one.
Right.
So and the other one, I think it may be less intuitive maybe, is tourism, right? I mean, our dollar being less is actually good for tourism. People will find that they can come to Australia and spend their money, enjoy our sights and sound and our everything.
It's one of my favorite things. We think about exports, we think about stuff we're sending overseas.
Yeah.
It's kind of counterintuitive to think about someone coming to Australia as an export. But kind of, if you think about the flow of goods and services, foreign money being spent on Australian goods and services, exactly what exports are.
Exactly, yeah.
And so tourism is actually, and it's one of our biggest exports. It's going to, as you said, really benefit from, look, I think that, I'm not a very thematic investor, I've got to say. I'm generally a bottom-up kind of guy. I don't look for themes and look for opportunities amongst that. But I can't help but find a lot of kind of the same ideas at play right now. When you think about the opportunities for both exports of goods and the opportunity for tourism exports, in the sense that there are many, many more, you know, kind of Chinese specifically and Asian more generally tourists who are becoming wealthier, who are traveling more, who have more money to spend on imported goods and services, who are looking for clean, green Australian experiences, products, services. We're kind of in the box seat, right? Like I'm not saying buy anything that's export related or anything that's tourism related, and yes, there'll be winners and losers regardless. But if you think forward, if you think about the big, big macro trends, one of those big shifts has got to be the growing number of dollars being spent on Australian exports, even dollar aside.
Yeah.
And then you add the dollar to that, it's hard not to see this as an opportunity, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, again, you know, some sectors are going to be doing hard because of the lower dollar. But I think that, you know, as you said, I think tourism is a good one. Even things like, you know, what people call more defensive assets, like, you know, airports, for example, right? You know, airports are going to have more tourists coming in. Therefore, the airport's going to make, you know, more sales on the shops and, you know, more travelers, more planes.
Right, China's arrival numbers are going through the roof. Just year after year after year, they're growing at double-digit rates.
Exactly.
We're in the box. Maybe the Australian economy will still struggle for a whole lot of different reasons, but man, we are blessed by a lot of tourism coming to the country and a lot of export sales that are going to simply grow in dollar value and in volume because of this lower Australian dollar.
Absolutely. And as you said, like, you know, clean, green, and a reputation for being safe, right?
Yep.
Those are really big deal drivers for people who are wanting to spend their money and having a good time.
Basically. Pretty good.
Yeah. So.
Now, let me ask you one question, though. Let me just play devil's advocate for a second. For all of that, the dollar is already at 71 cents. And there's no point buying yesterday's trend. If you knew the dollar was going to fall, when the dollar was 90 cents, if you knew it was going to fall to 71, that would have been the time, really the big time, to go and fill your boots with export stocks or tourism stocks or companies that rely on a lower Australian dollar. At 71 cents, you could argue the party is somewhat over, and maybe the right deal is actually do the reverse, to say, well, okay, maybe the dollar's going to go up next. And so maybe the time's over to be buying these sort of companies. What do you say?
So I'm a long-term investor here, and you know, I tend to invest with, like, you know, 10-year type of horizon. So, you know, the dollar as such, I don't pay that much attention.
Okay.
But if we talk about trends, I'll say a couple of things, and I'll go back to my favorite thing, banking, debt.
Here we go again.
The amount of household debt we've got basically has put the RBA in a, you know, the Reserve Bank, in a very sticky position, right? They can't increase interest rates fast enough because that's going to make, you know, make the household expenses go up more than people can sustain. On the other hand, the U.S. economy is, for example, growing at a very fast rate or relative to, I guess, what you'd expect. They're increasing rates and their rates are already higher than ours, right? And as we've talked many times here, the differential between the U.S. rates and our rates are going to have an impact in terms of, you know, the cost of borrowing and everything else, but it's going to also have an impact on the dollar, right? And I just don't see any catalyst in the, at least in the near term, of how our dollar is actually going to rise. I mean, I could actually see a scenario where our dollar is actually at 60 cents, right? So, you know, in my take is that maybe over you know, next several years, we are not in a situation where the dollar is going to reverse.
Now, the bull case for the dollar is that, okay, so the RBA does decide to raise rates and feel like the economy can sustain it. Commodity prices stay high, and so the rest of the world demands Australian commodities, which pushes up the dollar because they're buying more Australian dollars to buy our commodities. And the economy continues to be strong. So it kind of, you know, it supports or even pushes up the Australian dollar from here. You don't think that's likely, or just not on balance the most probable outcome, or simply the other force is still too strong to see the dollar rise from here?
So again, as I said, I my view is that, and again, and on the basis of what I think may happen, mm-hmm. so my most probable outcome is the dollar stays around where it is, mm-hmm. Or goes down mm-hmm. some more. I just don't see enough reasons for it to go up. That's my view.
Makes sense. But
of course, I deserve the 100% right to be wrong.
Exactly. Let's move on, mate. That's a great summary. Thank you. And I think, look, Phil, you know, this is, trying to forecast currency is stupidly crazy. And we kind of talk about it because it's in the zeitgeist and people are asking about it. As Doc said, we don't invest on the basis of currency. I think you're mad to do it. Buy good companies, buy great businesses. If you get a currency benefit out of it, then fantastic. That's the cherry on the cake. But trying to buy the cherry and ignore the cake is kind of putting the cart before the horse, to mix my metaphors horribly. And we suggest you don't do it.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, we got a question during the week, and it was a direct message, so I won't mention the questioner's name. If you do send us a question and you do it by direct message, please let us know if you want us to mention you. We won't unless you give us permission. If you do tweet us directly in public, we will obviously use it because you've put it in the public domain. Here's the question, Dog. At what point does a company price out its own customers? Examples, Apple's latest iPhone or NVIDIA's latest graphics cards, these are two US companies, which are the most expensive products from these companies to date. Should investors worry if a product or service of whom they are invested is priced too high? So kind of a double combination here. One is a bit of self-referencing. So, hey, the iPhone's getting a bit bloody expensive. So that, you know, for me personally is one question. The other is, how far can these guys push their price up? Do they run the risk of pricing themselves out of the market, out of the growth they've been enjoying so far? What say you?
This is a fantastic question. I mean, you know, in the analyst community and the people, the punditry, as I say, for a long time, they've been saying that, you know, there's only so much you can do in terms of raising prices for the iPhones.
Right.
And as I will quote what Warren Buffett has said, he has basically said that the iPhone's screen real estate is probably the most valuable real estate in the world.
That is my, that should have been obvious to everybody, but Buffett has a knack of putting this really clearly. When he talks about real estate, you know, he talks about real estate. Real estate is it's buildings, it's land, it's whatever. And you think about advertising on real estate or, you know, billboards, real estate. It's worth repeating that exact line, mate, because I think that is just stunningly great, isn't it?
Stunningly great. And you know, and nobody does it better than Buffett.
You're right, yeah. Plus, you agree with him, so that helps.
Plus, I agree with him. Plus, you know, he and I both hold the Apple shares, so, we, you know, we're both right. we believe, I'll use Buffett to say that I'm right. I mean, there is, of course, a limit to how much you can charge, but as Apple has shown that you can have high-end phones, the absolute high-end phones that you're charging a lot for. Mm-hmm. And then you basically, what Apple has done is basically kept the previous year's phones alive and running, and they've improved the software so that you have lower-end options as well. Mm-hmm. So it's basically just got a range of products now. And I mean, you know, some people like me are going to buy the new phones because they have to buy the new phones, and some people are not going to buy the new phones because they don't have to buy the new phones, and that's okay.
But at some point, I guess the question is, at some point, does this point to some sort of, are we getting close to the top of what they can price stuff at? So Peter Lynch talks about using the scuttlebutt method, right? See what people are doing, talking about, thinking about. Part of the scuttlebutt method is going, man, that phone's getting expensive. There can't be much more headroom on price, can there? Is that something we should be thinking about, at least in a relative sense?
So I think we're getting to the top end is my guess. Mm. But I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, year on year, some increase as they roll out new technologies, right? You know, the iPhone 10 basically had, you know, a lot of new things.
Yeah.
And therefore, they could charge that price. And people were, like, you know, very happy to pay that price. You know, you could see that in those numbers.
Indeed.
So I think there's a thing. And then the same thing with NVIDIA, you know, as he asked. I mean, NVIDIA's chips are doing more and more and more. And NVIDIA's chips have a lot of opportunity. And therefore, you can charge. Mm. It depends on the utility, as in the Buffett way, right? It depends on the utility. If people think it has a utility, people will pay for it, right? I mean, you know, why do people pay $60,000, $80,000 for a BMW car? Mm-hmm. You could drive a Kia and does exactly the same thing, takes you from A to B.
Right. That being said, if BMWs were originally priced as Kias and the price started going up, you'd expect them to sell less cars, right? Like, at some point, there is a trade-off there between what you're buying and what you're selling and how many of them you can sell. I will add one, and I don't think this is necessarily a Buffett one, but I think it is actually. I'm pretty sure I saw him on CNBC say something like this. If you think, not only is it valuable real estate, but if you think about how engaged we are with our phones, think about the number of hours we spend in a day, week, month, year on our phones, the ROI in terms of what we would spend for a month on Netflix or a ticket to the movies or whatever, if you break down a, let's call it a $1,000 phone because it makes my life easier, that's $10 a week. for 2 years.
Yeah.
And if you think about how much time you spend on that phone, it's probably, what, 20 cents an hour?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd pay more for a movie, you'd pay more for Netflix, you'd pay more for... Right, exactly. Yeah. And so it's a very, very high ticketed price. If you could pay for a phone by usage, it'd cost you $1 squillion, and people would pay it. If you actually... Apple will never do this, right? But if you actually gave people iPhones, we'll charge you 10 cents an hour for use, they would make a fortune. They make so much more than the price they're currently charging, right? Because we wouldn't be able to help ourselves. We all go broke trying to pay our phone bills.
Yeah.
It's just astonishing the amount of time, effort, and value we get out of these devices.
Yeah, and then it's brand power, right? I mean, Apple has the brand power to charge, and therefore, it's doing that.
Well, you can make people paying. Look, I think what I like about the question, though, mate, is it's scuttlebutt, as I said. The second is it kind of asks about how do we think about pricing? I think you and I pretty much believe that they're priced highly, but not unreasonably. And as you say, Apple has some smart people working on how much they can afford to charge for these things. And they're delivering growth year on year. In fact, a lot of their growth is actually coming from price increases, not from volume increase. Mm-hmm. But there is a natural cap to that. And at some point, you can't keep the price of phones increasing at a much faster rate than inflation for too long.
Yeah.
Eventually, you're going to price yourself out of every pot. You know, $2,000, $5,000, $10,000 for a phone. Of course, no one's paying that. So there is a natural limit. Apple hasn't found it yet.
Yeah.
Plenty of room to go.
Motley Fool Money.
Mate, we're going to go one last question before we wrap up. We're going a bit long, but I like it because I like answering some of our listeners' questions. And Phil, while you're listening, if you do have a question, you can hit us up two ways. You can hit us up on Twitter, @TheMotleyFoolAU is our corporate Twitter account. Hit us up with a question there, either by direct message or just simply tweet at us on Twitter. The other option is you can go directly to Anirban or myself. Anirban is Anirban Mahanti, all one word. I'm TMF Scott P. That's The Motley Fool. So TMF Scott P, P for Phillips. Or you can email us if you want to use email instead, info@fool.com.au. Send us a question, send us a comment, let us know what you think of the podcast, what you want us to talk about, topics, issues, questions. Please throw them at us, because as we say regularly, this podcast is for you. We like hearing the sound of our own voices, of course, but it's no fun doing it if no one listens. And if we do answer your questions, if we know what you're thinking, then it makes it more valuable for us and hopefully more valuable for you as well.
We love your questions. We bring them on.
Let's go. Two questions from a correspondent who again didn't give us permission to use their name, so we won't. Mm-hmm. But the first question is, this is a little bit inside baseball, mate. This is about our services.
Mm-hmm.
So we will answer it because it was asked. We won't spend too much time on it because some of our listeners may not yet be a member of our services. But hey, if you want to get full value out of this question, why not join one of the Motley Fool services, and then you'll know exactly what we're talking about. My wife and I have subscribed to ShareAdvisor, which is the one I run. You run Extreme Opportunities, and both are great services, we think. We're a bit confused with the number of recommendations. So if your aim is to beat the market, and we want to do the same, which is awesome, does it mean we need to buy each and every recommended stock? In other words, if we cherry pick some, how can we ensure we'd get a similar return as you will? This question is even more relevant if we decide to sign up for Extreme Opportunities, which is yours, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
From what we understand, Anirban is targeting higher growth stocks, but at the same time, it might mean more stocks might make more losses. How would we ensure we don't choose these making losses and miss the good ones?
That's a great question.
Answer that question for me, mate. In 25 words or less? Okay. 40 words. I'll give you 40 words.
You're putting me under pressure here. Number one is that you need to buy a number, especially if you're in extreme opportunities. Mm-hmm. You should be buying a number of stocks.
Yep.
You, if you buy just one, you might get the winner. You might get the loser.
Yep.
Right. In The Motley Fool, we say that, at least you should buy 15.
Yes.
You know, in my own personal views, you should buy maybe 30.
Yep. So David Gardner, our co-founder, says get to 15 as quickly as you possibly can as one of the first things out of the gate.
Yep.
Don't just stop at 15, but get to 15 as quickly as you possibly can.
Yeah, and that smooths out a lot of volatility. It also gives you more opportunities to win.
Mm-hmm.
In extreme opportunities, what we say is that if you want to match the performance of what our service is doing, you pretty much need to buy everything.
Yep.
Right. If you don't want to use it that way, and the reason we have said that is the service is relatively new. We don't have that many recs on it.
Yeah, right.
So, you can't really, choose, right? But at some point we'll get there. And then we'd probably say, you buy maybe 20 odd mm-hmm. to go and then you add what you like,
yep.
right? And I think that's what I would say, that, if you've bought enough,
mm-hmm.
you've diversified across different companies, maybe different sectors, if mm-hmm. you can, across the scorecard, you should get something similar. Mm-hmm. It won't be exactly the same, but you get something similar.
So just the kind of maths behind this, you're the scientist and the PhD in the room. Generally speaking, if you buy something that a large enough number that approaches a representative sample, it'd be like buying it. When we talk about diversification, the academics say roughly that 25 to 30 stocks, once you've bought that many, you're kind of going to approximate the index return.
Yeah.
And we say something similar when it comes to our services.
Yeah. So, you'd say that if you do, you pick 30 mm-hmm. you should get something very similar to the average. It's yep. if you pick 30 stocks from or 30 shares from EO, mm-hmm. we don't have 30, but if you did, yep. you should get something similar.
Or if you do over time, right?
Yeah, as I said, right now we don't,
yep.
And we are adding every month.
Yep.
But you know, you did the same thing on ShareAdvisor, and you should roughly, you know, you're never going to be exactly there, but yep. you know, the ShareAdvisor is beating the market over like more than 2x. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a performance that's similar to that,
right?
It might not be exactly. Maybe you do better, maybe do slightly worse. But you know, hey, if you're in that ballpark, you should be very, very happy.
And the more you are, the closer it is statistically to being
exactly
likely approximating.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'll add one more rider, mate, very quickly, because what I've seen members do in the past is they've cherry picked our recommendations, and they haven't bought a representative sample because they've said, well, okay, Scott, you made all these recommendations, but I'm only going to buy the retail stocks, or I'm only going to buy the tech stocks, or I'm only going to buy the fast growers, or I'm only going to buy the value stocks, or whatever else it is, and at some level, when you start to apply your own filter like that, the more you buy, the more chance you have of getting the average return. But it's entirely possible that, for example, I might be better at picking tech stocks than retail stocks, or Australian stocks versus US stocks, or whatever the form is. If you start to try and filter and delineate and only choose a certain subset, that subset may not get the average return of the total service.
Yeah.
And so I would say for members who are listening, and again, if you do want to join us, that'd be awesome. But either way, buy a representative sample from the scorecard, not just the retail stocks you like retail. Or don't ignore retail because you don't like retail. You want to pick a representative sample both in terms of number, but also a rough diversification across industry. It's important.
Yeah, I agree.
Motley Fool Money.
Mate, one last question before we wrap it up, and we will mm-hmm. try and get there reasonably quickly. Another question I have relates to having a mortgage and buying stock at the same time. Given the compounding interest, should we first aim to repay the loan and then start investing in shares? Or is it better to keep paying the loan as per the 30-year schedule and invest in shares, assuming the return on shares will be higher than the interest rate? That's a tough question. Now, we can't give personal advice, we will say. So this is general advice only. Doc, what's your thought on that? If you had a mortgage and you had an investment account at the same time, how would you balance the two?
Okay, so as you said, this is what I do. This, yep. this is my take, mm-hmm. not personal advice. We have a mortgage. Mm-hmm. And we pay the mortgage as it goes, like as whatever is the payment.
Mm-hmm.
The mortgage, you know, right now you can get one. You know, ours is around 4%, but I think if you work hard, you can get even lower ones.
Mm-hmm.
The stock market over the long term does 9%. That's the market,
mm-hmm.
right? If you're beating the market, you could do 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, even more,
yep.
right? That's a big difference. If you even just taking the market value 9% or 10% and minus that with 4, you're 6% ahead,
mm-hmm.
right? And the mortgage is probably the single biggest expenditure for right. any individual. It's if you want to pay that first, then you'll not invest.
Yep.
It's very difficult. Or fortunate people can do it, but not yes. not everyone.
Yep.
Right. So
because of your mortgages, how much you're earning, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yep. So for us, we have always invested in shares
mm-hmm.
because they have higher returns.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if there's some money sitting on the side because for some reason that it sits in an offset account, we are lucky that we have this facility in Australia to call, mm-hmm. which is called offset. But otherwise, you know, I'm not looking to pay it first. Of course, if there was a situation where the interest rates were to become 18%,
right.
as it did long time back,
yep.
yeah,
yep.
then it does make sense to actually pay that.
Yep.
Right. So what I would say is that if you have credit card debts,
mm-hmm.
those are typically higher. Pay that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would do.
Agree.
But when the mortgage rates are low, I'd still invest because you know it just got better opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do the same. So first thing I'll say is you know this is what I do. I will do exactly the same. We have a mortgage. We invest separately. We do both at the same time. If we break this back, if you're paying say 5% on a home loan, if you pay that off, the saving you make is effectively a much higher rate. When you consider the tax implication, because if I make 7% on shares, I've got to pay a portion of that, and let's call it 30% just to make life easy. I've got to pay 30% of that in tax, so that's 2.1% of that 7 goes in tax. I'm left with 4.9.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm paying 5% of my mortgage, I'm actually better off to pay the mortgage than to invest in shares, even though the nominal rate is higher, because paying off your home loan is a tax-free saving
mm-hmm.
or tax-free return, if you like, whereas shares are a taxable return. So there mm-hmm. is that thing to think about as well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, too, I would say, think about where you are with your mortgage relative to, and you talk about offset, relative to your repayment schedule. So if you get to a position where you lose your job or something else happens, you want to be a little bit ahead on the mortgage before mm-hmm. you do it. So again, there's what is technically correct, academically correct, versus what's kind of decent practice. I think there's some value in getting ahead on the mortgage personally. I'd also say that for what it's worth, think about the average return you're getting, but also your temperament, how you feel about that sort of return and where you really want that money to be. I think you're right, Doc. You are dead right. In terms of the compounding of both numbers, if you can compound your investments at a faster rate than the home loan's compounding, then you absolutely should invest in shares. That makes perfect sense. But the home loan being paid off is risk-free and tax-free. Mm-hmm. And those are two things that most of our listeners should keep very well at the front of their mind. So I invest in and pay off the mortgage, as do you, as do many people. I think that's probably still a good way for most people. But know yourself is probably the answer I would give. If you're someone who wants the certainty, if you like the saving the tax, if you like having effectively a risk-free payment, then it makes a whole lot of sense to pay the home loan off first, or at least pay it off substantially so you get yourself ahead of the mortgage. Otherwise, academically, if you can get the market's average return of 10% before tax, throw a couple of franking credits on top of that, maybe you get to 11 or 12 on average. Compare that to a 4 or 5% home loan rate. In fact, if you're paying 5%, you're paying too much unless you've got an investment property. So if you're fools out there, one piece of really actionable advice now. If you're paying more than 4% on your mortgage, go to your bank, demand a lower rate, or change banks. You shouldn't be paying more than 4% on an owner-occupied mortgage. That's my bit of effort, bit of that. Call it my mini rant. Mm-hmm. Go and get a better rate, please, because otherwise you're just paying the bank for nothing, which is just awful, awful waste. Otherwise, I think you should invest in shares over the long term. Do both. It makes sense.
I'll add one quick thing as well. So the other thing, the tax implication is real, but it depends on where you're investing. So if you're investing, for example, from a super, you're not paying that tax. Also, if you're not, you're paying lower tax.
Correct.
Right. And if you're holding your shares and not selling them, you're not paying any tax right now.
Yep.
Which is, I mean, the other thing that, you could do in your investment is, I tend to hold long term. And if you hold long term, you're not paying any tax on it. You're paying tax on your dividends and things like that. Mm-hmm. But you're getting some franking credits, So a lot of these things can work to your advantage.
Yep.
And the final thing that I would say is that, when I invest in stocks, one of the things that happens for me is that money seems to have disappeared somewhere else.
Totally.
And therefore, I have less propensity to spend it on something else.
Yep. And the other thing, too, I will say, I'll like very quickly to this. The other thing about paying the mortgage off first, it makes sense. If you want to do that, go for it. As long as you make yourself put exactly the mortgage repayment into shares once you've paid off the house. Plenty of people will say, let's pick a number. Let's say we're paying $2,000 a month off the house, right? Let's just pick that number. Mm-hmm. If you pay $2,000 a month forever until you pay the house off, you ought to put that $2,000 the month after, it's going to go straight into shares. Mm. Most people will say, oh, thank God I paid it off. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take half that money. I'll go for a holiday. Mm-hmm. I'll put the other half in shares. You actually will, and this is where behavioral finance is so incredibly valuable and important. Mm. Once you give yourself permission to not do that, all of the benefits we've just talked about completely evaporate because you've gone and wasted that money and you spent it rather than investing it instead of paying off the mortgage. So as long as you're really, really consistently doing it, then there's value. I would say to your point, Doc, you want to create good habits now. And again, it's kind of, what's academically correct, what's theoretically correct, they're all interesting. What's far more valuable is what you can behaviorally do and do regularly. That's the important one.
Yeah, know yourself, fools. Know yourself.
That'll do us. Fools, thank you very much for listening to another Motley Fool Money. We do love doing it, as I said, and thank you very much for taking the time, making the effort. We love hearing your thoughts, comments, and feedback, so please send us some more mailbag. Doc, that does wrap us up. Before we go, we would like our listeners to subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through Apple iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And of course, you can go to fool.com.au/MMM, and you will get the best The Motley Fool has to offer our free newsletter, a little bit of marketing, to be fair and to be clear, but we reckon there's some pretty good deals you want to take advantage of as well. Until next week, fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.